The Olympics, European Championships, the Paralympics, Wimbledon, just some of the events that did not happen this year. So, as we all now live in a world and a country with more tears than Paul Gascoigne, we're going to look back at the last 12 months and ponder what the hell just happened. Welcome to the Sportspiel Review of the Year 2020. Yes, hello everyone. Welcome to the show that we traditionally do at this time of the year. Bit different though to all the other different versions we've carried out so far. Before we dive into it, let me introduce my co-host on the podcast, Will Moulton, who I'm actually thinking back, I haven't actually seen you in person since March.
Yeah, the last time we saw each other, was that at when you did the half marathon, or was that when we did the live episode?
The live, when we sat in a bar preparing to do our show and talked about this coronavirus thing, it'll all blow over.
We were speaking to Ailey, of course, as well, and about her hopes for the year, and they've been dashed, as of many of the hopes of athletes that we've had on the podcast. It's Jesus, what a year it's been.
Yes. So, as a little pointer to listeners, if you listen back to our last review of the year for 2019 and a lot of the stuff we were bigging up in advance for 2020, Olympics and so on, it's really quite something listening back to some of that now, knowing what we know now as to how much life and the world has changed. The first being that we actually recorded that in person, but the second with pretty much everything that we said and were building up to hasn't happened. But there is still a lot of sport that, thankfully, we've had to talk about and that we can look back on. And I suppose, if anything, before we dive into sort of the individual sections of this particular episode, this year has probably summed up more than any other year could just how important sport is to people. Not just athletes, but to people from an entertainment standpoint and also from just a general well-being standpoint, I suppose.
Yeah, massively. I mean, for me, having sport back is it gives me something to look forward to. And that is something I'm really lacking in at the moment for various reasons. So to say, oh, I can sit down this weekend at 12:30 and watch a game at lunchtime on Saturday on BT Sport, or I can sit down we've got Champions League in the evening, or there's a live cricket game going on, or there's some rugby or whatever. It's just been... Yeah, it makes you appreciate how much, for a lot of people, sport means. And yeah, like I said, it's giving us something to look forward to at a time where looking forward to things isn't really a possibility because we just don't know what's around the corner.
Definitely. Something to... a little bit of escapism from the way the world is. Speaking from personal perspective, when pretty much 80% of my job has become coronavirus, and then when I log off, I really don't need more virus in my life. Which is a little bit difficult when we're both in tier four right now as well. So having those little things to look forward to definitely helps.
I've actually set myself a challenge at work. Wherever possible, I'm trying to avoid using the words coronavirus and lockdown in our social pieces and our website pieces. I'm just sort of trying to skirt around the fact of what's happened this year because we all know what's happened this year. Like, we don't need to see those words anymore than we already have. So I hope people have picked up on that looking at the England and GB accounts, that we're trying our hardest not to mention those words and trying to keep everything positive, because essentially everything we were used to, or not everything, but a lot of things we were used to will come back. It's just we need to remind ourselves that we just need to find a way of getting through this, and then things will eventually get better, even if we do keep having to take steps backwards.
Exactly. And as you alluded to as well, we're going to try and keep this episode relatively coronavirus free, kind of impossible task to do. But it's sort of our main aim of today is to talk a lot about the positive things, the inspiring things that we've seen in sport throughout the year. Speaking of which, you've obviously just logged onto this Zoom call after spending a morning running around Kent dressed as Santa.
Oh no, according to the government, we're technically London.
Are you? Interesting. Tearful, nonetheless.
Yeah, still tearful.
But how was that?
It was difficult. I mean, at the start of the year, I hated running. Got into running with a friend and found that it's just very good for me because exercise is something that allows me to release the emotions that I sort of build up, and I don't vent very well. So doing exercise is quite good for that. And the harder I work, sort of the better I feel afterwards. So I've got into running quite a bit and decided I wanted to set myself a challenge. So I said, I'm going to run my first ever 10K because I've done a lot of 5Ks, 6Ks, a few 7Ks, but I was like, well, might as well big it up to a 10K. It's not that much of a challenge really compared to what some people do. And I wanted to do it dressed as Santa because I had a Santa suit from previous times at uni, and I was just like, it's a bit of fun. I did it for sport in mind as well, because sort of going on the theme of what we've been talking about, the importance of sport and physical exercise, like some of the work they do is amazing. There are so many great charities out there, but I just thought my beliefs echoed quite well with what they do. So raised more than double what I plan to raise. I did the run this morning, Christmas Eve. And yeah, it was difficult. Got quite warm. I'm glad I didn't do it yesterday because the temperature was 13 degrees yesterday. It was only 6 today and I was still sweating. But it was nice running around and a lot of people waving at you. I ran past one person who said that I'd made their day, you know, just chatting to people on the way around, saying Merry Christmas, like seeing kids sort of come alive. I walked past one guy and his young son, and the dad just called me a legend, which was quite nice. So hopefully I brought a bit of Christmas cheer to those in and around Bexley today. And thank you as well, Alistair, for your support and your donation. And thank you to everyone who's given money to a fantastic cause. And thank you for not throwing things at me if I ran past you.
Christmas spirit there. But definitely a very worthwhile cause. Mm. And like you say, it's always a bit of a sight seeing Santa running around doing his 10K.
Especially when his beard's not on properly.
Yeah, I don't know where the beard ended up in the end, sort of round your head or something.
But I can demonstrate for those. Oh no, I can't. Oh no, I can. For those who are watching on YouTube, so the beard was supposed to be here, ended up being here. So just a big chin strap.
It's just a weird neck beard that you haven't tamed over time.
Yeah, but the moustache is still very much ginger. I dye that bit.
Speaking of not taming hair as well, and 2020 has probably been the year that I've experimented with my hairstyles more than anything.
It's good to see the booth on quick black.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if it is classed as that anymore, because I shaved it twice completely. And
twice?
Now I did. Yeah.
I thought it was only the once.
No, I did it a second time as well, just to keep on top of it. And now I'm at the point, or more rocking the look that basically says to people, I've not been to a barber since before the second lockdown. So a real year of experimentation for a lot of people, I'm sure. But anyway, time to launch into our review of the year proper. Those who have listened to these before will know that it's a little bit like a sort of a mini awards thing, in that we tend to pick out some categories, talk through our nominees, but then ultimately come up with an ultimate winner of each category. This year's categories are a little bit slimmed down compared to usual, since there hasn't been as much to talk about, but nonetheless, four still very important categories that we're going to talk through. First one is the best moment in sport of 2020. Second one is our inspirational athlete or moment of 2020 as well. And then the last two is very much sports and athlete based, in that we're going to be talking through our team of the year for 2020 and our athlete of the year for 2020, which obviously very highly prestigious awards that I'm sure come only second to some of the awards that we've seen dished out recently, most notably at Sports Personality of the Year, which was a few days ago. So I'm sure the recipients will gladly take these shout outs just as it will be just as valued as what the BBC might have spoken about a few days ago. But we also have a lot of our own to talk about. So we will talk about our best moment of 2020 after this.
You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast.
So, the best moment in sport of 2020, and essentially this year, there's probably a much broader scope for us to choose from. A lot of the time, we usually pick something that, you know, we've either been to or seen on TV, usually some sort of sporting event, but I think this year, it summed up just how important, like we talked about at the start, those smaller, more personal events can be. So they might factor in here. As ever, we'll kind of go back and forth in terms of our nominees before we come up with our overall winner each. And we'll probably fight it out again to see who gets crowned the ultimate winner. But would you like to go with your first nominee for best moment?
Yep. So my first nominee is pre-COVID. It was a time when...
What was that time?
It was a time when we barely even knew the word existed. And it's actually a good friend of the podcast. And I say a friend of mine. I hope she sees me as a friend as well, but you never know. But Shona McCallan, someone we've had on quite a few times. We all know, for those of us who know her or those of you who know this, her story, what she's been through in the last couple of years, it's not been easy for her at all. She was selected to go out to Australia and New Zealand for the opening FIH Hockey Pro League games this year. And I was lucky enough for the first time to get to travel with the squads as well. So I was out there covering the games. And I can't remember exactly when I had this feeling, but I just remember thinking, like, before the game started, I think probably on my plane journey over, thinking, I don't know why, but I've got a feeling that Shona's going to score this tournament. And I don't know why, because she's scored two international goals previously and both for England, never for GB. But I just had a feeling she was going to score. And in the third game against New Zealand, she produces an absolute worldie. And I just remember it happened right in front of my eye line. It was one of those plays that you could see what was happening and you knew what was going to happen. You just sort of couldn't quite believe it. Tess Howard, someone we've also had on this podcast, puts in this amazing ball, Shona diving, gets the stick on it, puts it into the corner. The celebrations were amazing. And I remember just putting out the tweet, which was something like, wowee, McCallan's just scored a worldie. And the goalkeeping coach was sitting next to me and he was just like, yeah, you couldn't have summed that up any better in that tweet. And it was just so nice to see her scoring. I think in the next game, she then played her 50th game for GB as well. So a milestone the next day. And yeah, a special goal to witness in person, and especially for someone that you know well and you know what they've been through. So a personal one to start off with.
Definitely. And I'm sure the first personal one of many personal ones that we're going to talk about as we go on. My first nominee, not so much personal one because I wasn't there, but I watched it. And that is the Ultimate Garden Clash, which people might not have been familiar with the name, but they'll certainly remember the scenes on TV. So this is when essentially, or rather to me, it just shows the genius solutions that people could come up with to get some sort of sport and entertainment back on TV for everyone to watch and enjoy. This is going back to May now, so it's still early-ish days of the pandemic, but it was essentially when former Olympic champion pole vaulter Renaud Lavillenie conceived the idea, the Ultimate Garden Challenge, the Ultimate Garden Clash even, where three of the world's best pole vaulters would compete in an online contest from their back gardens. So the other two competitors were Mondo Duplantis and Sam Kendricks. And they basically had to clear a 5-meter bar as many times as possible in two 15-minute time slots, so half an hour in total. Lavillenie and Duplantis were joint winners. They cleared the bar 36 times in half an hour, which is quite a lot when you think about it. And to me, that is one of the ones that sums up sport this year, in that we've had to go virtual, we've had to get a little bit creative here and there to get things to work as we like them to. But it shows to me the drive and the ingenuity for people just to give people or give sports fans that level of enjoyment that we've missed out on for so long, particularly during the first lockdowns that a lot of the countries around the world were experiencing at that time. And that was one of the first big events that came back and caught everyone's attention.
Yeah. Also, speaking of Duplantis, he went and broke the world record this year that people said wasn't going to be broken. So, insane.
What about 2020 for everyone?
Pole vault's one of those, it's a very tight-knit community, isn't it? You see that, like, the same people compete against each other all the time, but they're also best mates. So it's always an interesting watch, the men's and the women's as well.
Yeah.
So I started off, my first nominee was something that happened right at the start of the year, and then bringing up very much something that happened just a few weeks ago. And this was England women's second game against France. So they'd previously played Italy at the start of November to win the Grand Slam. Then they played France in two games. And the first one, they beat the French quite convincingly. But the second one, the French really hit back and proved a lot of the doubters wrong and proved that they are still one of the best teams in the world. They were 15-5 up at halftime. French were dominant till the 60th minute. Scarrett was only on the bench with Daley McLean starting at 10 and Zoe Harrison, another of our guests, starting at 12. Scarrett comes off the bench along with a load of other subs after 50 minutes and the game turns. Poppy Cleland, Ellie Cordun score two late tries to bring England back to within 1 point. And then in overtime at the end of the game, they win a penalty. And I guess the pressure was slightly off given that there were no fans in the stadium. But the fact was Scarrett had a fairly difficult kick that she still needed to nail. And this was to keep their place as number one test side in the world. And she stepped up and slotted it home. And she made it look so easy. And that was something we'll talk about later. But that's proof of where this England women's rugby team is at the moment, in that they may not be playing their best and that they can still find a way of getting a victory. And with a World Cup coming up, hopefully very soon, that's a massive marker, that victory against the French. And I mean, Emily Scarrett's just an insane player. Like the amount of talent she possesses is unreal. And yeah, to step up and score under such pressure was remarkable. And it just would have been so much better if fans could have been there to witness it.
Definitely. One hell of a finish to a game. And even though fans weren't there, just even by seeing it from afar, really makes quite the impression. And spoiler alert, Emily Scarrett might be talked about again later on.
And the England women's rugby team
might also be talked about again later on. But who knows? We'll see. My next one is, I suppose, a very broad one rather than a specific moment, but I've essentially just called it when football came back. So this is, I suppose, again, early days of the pandemic, but when we needed sport the most, from my perspective anyway, because we've been so long without it. And when football first came back, initially in Germany, and then obviously in other places, and eventually back here as well, that was probably the best thing me personally could have asked for at that particular point in time. We weren't sure what it would look like without fans and with this crowd noise over the TV and all that sort of stuff, and wondering whether the intensity would be there in the way we were used to, or if it was just sort of this half-baked product compared to what we're usually seeing on a weekly basis. But I think we can all kind of agree that it's brought entertainment, it's brought joy, it's brought escapism, and ultimately storytelling that's positive, that we can just see play out in front of us. And I also think we can all agree that considering there have been no fans for a large part of the seasons, or the remainder of last season, the start of this season, I still think seeing the players' self-motivation to perform at high intensity and putting their absolute everything into the cause, even without people shouting and cheering them on in the background, is probably a testament to those players that we probably don't talk about enough. And that's ultimately helped us enjoy such entertainment. It's almost, yes, we still miss the fans and we miss the presence of the fans. And I think when we briefly were able to get, 2,000 fans into a stadium, I think there's only two stadiums now in the entire Premier League, for example, that can actually hold fans now, thanks to the new tiers. But that added an extra level and showed just how much they've missed. But still so much for us to look forward to when a weekend comes around. And certainly for me, when I'm spending a large part of my week talking about all the negativity in the world is what I look forward to, and have looked forward to since the day it came back, basically. And again, sums up just how important getting away from it all and football has been to a lot of people. And football coming back was a large part of bringing that sense of normality back to our lives.
I know with professional athletes, essentially going out and playing the sport is just them doing their jobs. That's what they're paid to do. But actually, for so many of us, it means so much more that they can do that. And the fact is that they are playing at the same levels. They're playing at the same intensity. You know, they're not taking this lightly. They still want to win. And that's, if they were doing it half-assed, that would be quite a difficult watch. But we can see how much it means to them. Like Sadio Mane, for example, the other day, as a Liverpool fan, like Liverpool winning 4-0 up, he gets substituted on the hour mark and he comes off moaning and groaning because he wanted to stay on the pitch, and has a face of thunder when Mo Salah comes on and scores twice because he wanted to be doing that. People can say, yeah, blah, 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 Klopp's lost control of the dressing room. But for me, to see Mane taking it so seriously was just like, was amazing. And the fact that so many athletes have come back and, you know, they are doing their job, but they're doing it to entertain us, it's massively appreciated. My best moment of the year,
there's a word of winners now,
is a cricketing one, no surprise. Cricket without fans, like, I feel like the added noise and sound effects works fairly well with football and rugby, but I never found it worked that well with cricket. So when there were sort of lulls in the play and when things were going a bit slowly, like, it was quite a difficult watch. But when things were going, when the cricket was electrifying, which it was quite a lot of the time, like, it didn't matter. And one of the best examples of that was the incredible comeback from Chris Wokes and Jos Buttler against Pakistan in the test match. I think it was the first test of the series. England were 117 for 5, chasing 277 to win on a pitch that looked like it was doing all sorts. I think Ollie Pope got an unplayable delivery and it looked like it was absolutely no fun to bat, and people were writing England off. And Buttler, whose place had been talked about all the summer, you know, did he deserve to be there? Chris Wokes, again, not in the greatest of form with the bat since being bouncer barraged by the Aussies last summer. They just went on a counter-attack and they played some incredible cricket to turn the game around. And unfortunately, they weren't both there at the end, but, you know, Wokes saw the game home with Stuart Broad and Buttler made 75. And it was electrifying cricket, and it was amazing to see that the resilience of this team come through once again. We look at the World Cup final last year and how the one-day team won that. You look at the heroics of Ben Stokes in that Headingley Test match. England's men have a way of getting themselves out of trouble at the moment with remarkable performances. And while it can be frustrating when they're rubbish and they're struggling and they look like they can't bat, when they then pull off one of these remarkable comebacks, as they keep doing at the moment, it's special to watch. And you didn't need a crowd there to enjoy watching that game of cricket if you're a cricket fan. And again, it proved the ebbs and flows of a test match can't be beaten. Yes, 2020 is all good fun, but really, when you get test matches like that where a team seems to be out of it and then they pull off the remarkable, it's pure cricket to watch. And again, it is just a shame that there wasn't a crowd there to cheer them on, because it was almost as incredible as what Ben Stokes did. Not quite, because that was single-handed, but what Buttler and Wokes did was amazing, and it'd just been lovely to have had some fans there to appreciate that. But doesn't detract from what an amazing batting effort it was.
Kudos. I will send some sort of appreciation for that. Slightly disagree on the sound effects, by the way, the crowds. I don't like them. I've watched everything with natural stadium noise since this began, which seems to go against the grain for a lot of people. But hey ho, that's just me. My winner is more of a personal one, and kind of podcast related, but this basically goes back to, again, first lockdown, when the 771 challenge started doing the rounds for a lot of people, and we took part in one for the Mintridge Foundation, our lovely charity partners. And for me, that kept us all going at that particular time, and as well as it obviously being for a worthy cause. But essentially the challenge for anyone who doesn't remember was essentially getting seven people combined to do a marathon distance over 7 days, whether that was walking, running, scooting, bicycling, cycling, that's the word I'm looking for. And it was just a good way of getting a group together virtually and raising some money up for a good cause, like I said. Summed up to me how much people turned to exercise again during the first lockdown, and how it has the potential to pull you through when you're going through some tough times with the way of the world. And again, from my perspective, I see a lot of the worst in people on a daily basis in my job. Not going to lie, stabbings, murders, etc. But this is, or when everyone started doing this was the very best in people, which is always great to see when you've got this big movement coming together to do something like that. And again, from our perspective, we had a sports build crew that did it together as a seven, and we raised a nice healthy amount of money. I did one at work as well, where I got a group of my colleagues together to take part, and it just helped keep everyone connected when it could have been so easy just to drift off into your own little worlds and become a bit more isolated. But particularly when, because that was should have been the weekend of the original London Marathon, again brought a show sports power to bring everyone together. So for me, that's my best sporting moment of 2020.
Can't argue with that.
Thanks.
This podcast is a member of The Bear, internet radio and podcast network. Find more great podcasts at thebear.live.
Moving on to our second category of today's podcast, and that is inspirational athlete slash moment, because when we're actually talking about it or coming up with our nominees, there are actually quite a few situations where there was a lot more than one person to shout about. So that's why I brought in the word moment, just to make it more all-encompassing. Shall I go first this time with my first nominee, since you went first last time?
Go for it. Knock yourself out.
Thank you. A name that will probably be familiar to a lot of people, particularly in recent weeks, because this initially started back in November and finished off this month, but Kevin Sinfield, the former Leeds Rhinos player, and he's the current director of rugby at the club. Basically, in November, he said he would run seven marathons in 7 days to raise £77,777 for his ex-teammate and friend Rob Burrow. And we all know what Rob Burrow has had to go through since his diagnosis with motor neuron disease. Anyone who's seen that BBC documentary that came out, I think again in November, possibly October, looking at how Rob Burrow has fared in the last few months since his diagnosis, it's obviously horrible to see where he's at now. But in terms of inspiration, we could talk forever about Rob Burrow as well and what he's doing to raise awareness for motor neuron disease, and the way his family are continuing to fight as well. But what Kevin Sinfield has managed to do, it's just incredible, quite frankly. He took part in the first of those seven marathons on December the 1st, and he'd already exceeded that fundraising target by that point. It's now surpassed £2.6 million when he set out to have 77,777 quid as his initial one. That just shows how many people have backed him and what he's been able to do. And let's be honest, seven marathons in 7 days is tough, really, really tough. And I think when he was on Sports Personality of the Year the other day, did I hear rightly that I think he was averaging like 3 hours and 40 minutes, something like that, for some of them, which is a phenomenal marathon time anyway. So shows how fit a guy he is at the same time. But essentially, I can't really add anything more to what an effort, what a fundraising achievement, what a man. And to me, the relationship between Kevin Sinfield and Rob Burrow is one of the best things I've seen throughout the last year and going back into back into 2019 as well. And again, restores your faith in humanity when you see things like that.
Mm. my first nomination is another thing. It's not quite as impressive, but it's another thing that restores faith in humanity. And this actually happened. This finished today, Christmas Eve, as we record. But so many people have done so many amazing challenges across lockdown. But this one really stood out to me just because of the longevity of the challenge. So a 7-year-old called Charlie Slack from Leicestershire today completed a 325-mile lockdown running challenge. So when on the 20th of March it was first announced that the likelihood of a lockdown was going to happen, and 3 days later we went into it, he decided that he wanted to keep himself active by just going for a mile's run every day. And he's done that since. There have obviously been some days where he's done more miles as well, hence the 325. But every single day he's gone out as a 7-year-old to complete a mile, sometimes with his dad, sometimes by himself. Well, probably not by himself given his age. Probably he's had someone with him at all times. But
I hope so.
To have that stamina, to have that resilience, to have that drive at such a young age is so impressive. And he's raised £3,700 for three children's charities, which again, for someone of his age and the fact that it wasn't particularly well publicised until today, is incredible. And reading into his story as well, he actually, when he was younger, nearly died from meningitis. And now he's a 7-year-old who's run 325 miles this year. I don't think I've ever run 325 miles in my lifetime. So there have been so many incredible challenges taken on this year, but that one just stood out for me because of how young he is and the fact that he's done that every day. That's impressive.
That is a resilient 7-year-old, let me tell you. And yeah, going on with the challenges, this is kind of brings in my next nominee as well. And this one specifically is the 100K in May. This was another one linked to motor neuron disease as well. That was basically a large group of people who, or included a lot of footballers as well, basically came together to raise at least £50,000 this time for the Derby Rimmer MND Foundation by running and walking 100K in May. That foundation, of course, as a lot of people probably know, was launched by former footballer Stephen Darby and his friend and British Forces veteran Chris Rimmer, as they both have MND. And this fundraising effort was, again, a huge show of collective inspiration, spearheaded a lot by the England captain, women's football captain, Steph Houghton, who's Stephen Darby's wife. And so many others who took part of it. So I think I saw it basically dominate my social media feed for the time that challenge went. Georgia Stanway, someone who took part in it, I think she was a top fundraiser as well. Jay Spearing took part in it. Gary Bowyer took part in it. There were a group of the WSL referees also took part in it. And in terms of beating your fundraising target, 50,000 was the initial one, and they ended up raising over £200,000. So again, sums up just how brilliant it's been to see huge groups of people come together for one cause. And it helps spread the awareness as well when you have so many voices all channeled in the same direction.
I think that's one thing we can all take from this year, is that the community amongst sport, even if you don't play football, if you do another sport, people are still helping out in that thing. And sport is essentially one big family, which is amazing. And that leads me on to my next nomination, which is, it's what has inspired me this year is everyone who's worked behind the scenes to get sport back. And that's not just at a professional level that we can watch it, but also those people who work tirelessly at clubs to make sure that all the COVID restrictions are in place, fixtures are organized, coaching sessions are organized, you've got umpires, you've got players. The amount of work that goes into that sort of thing anyway, as someone who works for a governing body, that we see the amount of work that's needed to just organize, you know, a club's weekends. But given all the restrictions that have come in, the fact that people have been able to go out and safely play sport. Obviously, there have been restrictions come in recently, which means that some of us can't, which is a shame, but we can understand why at the same time. But yeah, so many people have gone behind the scenes and done some incredible work this year to allow us to do what it is that we love. And I benefited from that in the summer playing cricket. You know, I haven't enjoyed playing cricket for so long as I did this summer, because I was just out there with my mates in the sun winning games, which helped as well. But it was, yeah, it was incredible. So a massive thank you to everyone, whatever part that you've played in allowing us to play or watch sport this year.
Yeah, no, I think how many people that involves, but every tiny little bit all adds up to what we're saying now. So huge kudos to everyone you've mentioned. My winner, and probably I think as you alluded to before we started recording, this is probably the most obvious pick I could have gone for, but Marcus Rashford, who's had one hell of a 2020, from essentially footballer to people's champion in a lot of ways. And he's the one who's essentially taken it upon himself this year to change the world for better. He's campaigned to end child food poverty. He's started a children's book club, which a lot of people forget about as well, in amongst the sea of goodness that he's been involved with. And he's also taken on the government and won, which is quite a list of accolades for 2020. Not to mention he was also awarded an MBE and has arguably become, maybe, this is up for debate, but probably the most admired athlete right now in this country. From no matter who you talk to, who you support, what corner of the country you're from, you can't really find someone who has a bad word to say about Marcus Rashford. And he's just a perfect example to me of what an inspiring role model can be and can do. When you're in his position, it can be so easy, I suppose, to go on the attack, maybe. Go on the offensive against whether it's the government or anything like that. But just the way he handles himself and the way he's always so calm and just relentlessly dedicated to just bringing positivity and changing things for the better, a lot of people could learn from what he's been doing this year. There's more Marcus Rashfords in the world. The world is a better place.
Isn't he just the perfect example of someone who's recognised their platform and used it for good?
Yeah, hands down.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. For someone in a sport where a lot of young players get criticised quite a lot, for him to have come out and done that, and it's almost changed how we view footballers as well, or viewed him as a footballer. And even if he has a bad game now, I think people are less quick to criticise him because they think he has just had a bad game, but think of everything else that he's done. And that's how it should be, because, yeah, it's easy to criticise athletes, but at the end of the day, they're human and they are just trying their best. If they have a few bad weeks, like, that's allowed. And I think what he's done is sort of shown us that actually athletes are human. In a way,
the human side. Even then, you say bad games. When did he last have a bad game? A sustained period.
I mean, he plays for Man United, so it's not the easiest of times at the moment. But
exactly. But then, even to me, like, if you can still elevate your game, which I think he has on the field, while also doing all this off the field, that's even more respect from me from what you already had to juggle all of that and be successful in all of it.
I'm excited as well for you. You mentioned the book club there. He's doing that in conjunction with Carl Anker, who I believe works for The Athletic.
He does. He's there, Manchester United.
And Katie Warner, who is a psychologist who works with our men's team at GB Hockey and is one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. So that's a very exciting project. Someone else who's galvanised the country in a slightly different way and slightly earlier on wins my inspirational moment. And yes, I technically know it's not sport in the sense of how a lot of us see sport, but Captain Tom, I couldn't.
Someone said that to me the other day and I was like, it's a sporting challenge, it counts.
I mean, what essentially was a man walking up and down his garden turned into this phenomenon. And I don't even know like how the news got wind of it or anything, but he gave us something, again, something to look forward to, something to smile about at the very, very start of all of this. And he's almost become the British poster boy for we can get through this, which is an incredible achievement. You literally can't find fault with the man. He's just incredible. The way he galvanized everyone, the way he got everyone to support him, the amount of work he now does, like you see him popping up on all sorts of things, doing inspirational speeches and voiceovers. I don't want to mention his age much because it seems like I'm patronizing him, but you know, he's 98, 99 years old and he's doing all of this. If he can do it, we can all do it. And he's just every time I think about him, every time he's mentioned, he just puts a smile on your face. And yeah, in a really, really difficult year, he's been the shining light for me.
It doesn't really feel fair to pit off Captain Tom against Marcus Rashford, does it?
I mean, they've both done incredible things. Let's just say they've
everyone's done. A winner. That's our mantra for this year. Cool. Moving on to our next category then, which is Team of the Year after this.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn.
So, Team of the Year, which, when we were comparing notes before we began recording this podcast, had a very recognisable theme. Bearing in mind, we planned this individually. We didn't talk to each other, but essentially we've come up with the exact same two nominees and the exact same winner. So if anything, if more conclusive than anything else, I think out there in terms of award ceremonies, two people who agree wholeheartedly.
Absolutely.
Should we start with Liverpool then? Take us through Liverpool.
Go on then. Man. Oh, it felt so good to finally win a Premier League title. I say win a Premier League title. To see Liverpool win a Premier League title, it's 30 years is a long time to go for a club of Liverpool size without winning the league. But it's the way they did it for me. I know they had a few wobbles. The 3-0 defeat to Watford springs to mind immediately.
Have a weird day.
That was a very strange day. But to win the league in the manner they did was, I thought, very impressive. And yes, then their first game after winning the league, they lost 4-0 to Man City, which wasn't great. And they had a difficult start to this season. They only just beat Leeds. They lost 7-2 to Aston Villa. That was a dark day. But the way they've sort of fought back from that rocky start, and yeah, you can mention the injuries, but a club of Liverpool stature, you should be able to deal with that level of injuries. You should have the squad depth, and Liverpool have proved that they do. So to be leading the title at Christmas, leading the charge for the title at Christmas, having had that poor start again, sort of reaffirms that they're not one season wonders. That they may not win the league this year, but they're certainly putting up a good fight for it at the moment. And whether you like Jurgen Klopp or not, I know there are people out there who find him quite irritating, but what he's done to transform that club has been impressive, considering how rubbish they were under previous managers.
Considering where they were when he first arrived, that is one hell of a transformation. And like you say, despite the odd blip here and there, like the 3-0 against Watford and the Manchester City result that you talked about, still 99 points in the season, which is the second highest ever in the Premier League campaign. So definitely a lot to shout about. And obviously from my perspective, the relentless consistency, still top of the table now. And considering what they did the season before that as well, when they admittedly didn't win the league, but came really, really close, best ever runners up, then you can only appreciate that level of consistency. To play devil's advocate, and I'll get your opinion on this, is there an argument to say the season before was better than the season they actually won the title when they won the Champions League?
Their defence was a bit sounder that season.
I know they won Spotting Team of the Year, but to me it wasn't quite perfection, which is why they're only a nominee for me as well, rather than the actual winner.
I just thought there was a team out there who've done something more impressive, but the year they won the Champions League, when they didn't win the league, they had that period of 3 or 4 weeks where they drew games they shouldn't have drawn, and they bottled it. Oh, you can say bottled it, they choked, whatever. I think they let the pressure get to them when they were leading by so many points to let Man City catch them up. Whereas I think what I think was more impressive about last season was that they, whenever teams threw something at them, they always had something to hit back with. They knew how to deal with it a bit better. That's why I still think the league, I mean, I love the fact that they won the Champions League. Incredible. Well, actually, I prefer the semi-final of that Champions League win against Barcelona to the actual final. But I think that the last season winning the league was more impressive for me, even though the defence wasn't quite as secure as it had been the season before.
Nor was the Champions League run that impressive. But hey, I'm being picky. Also, quick word on Jordan Henderson, I think, because to me, he's, again, established himself as a real, like, not just talisman on the pitch, but off the pitch as well, and becoming, like, a really important spokesperson for a lot of things. So, yeah, shout out to him from me.
He gets absolutely slated, Henderson. People saying, oh, why is he, you know, why do people vote for him for FIFA Best Player of the Year? Or, you know, he's not actually that good a footballer, but the way he galvanises that team, what I found really interesting was Liverpool shared a clip a few weeks ago of just him in a Champions League game, the things he was saying to his teammates, like the things you wouldn't hear if a crowd was there. And, you know, he really does lead that team. And he's a good player. Like, I know he gets criticised a lot for his sideways passing and stuff, but Liverpool are better when he's in the team because he drives things forward. He does make things happen. I think he's a great player and he seems like a good bloke as well.
Definitely. Scored a good goal last weekend, so against Palace. Second nominee then, and it is Mercedes, the F1 team. Personally, I don't think the teams in Formula 1 the teams behind the drivers get as much credit as they should do. I know a lot of people just bang on about the drivers or bang on about the car, but car is that good for a reason. Essentially, the Mercedes F1 team, their record is ridiculous right now. And if we're going along the lines of consistency like we were for Liverpool, they have now won the Constructors' Championship every year since 2014, which I believe is a record in terms of consecutive championship wins. So that is 7. But yeah, like I say, people bang on about the car, but that's the whole point. The team produces that car and produces tactics that bring win after win after win. And that fit with Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg when he won the title, Valtteri Bottas, I suppose, to some extent now, it just seems to fit. And that team is just so far superior with all the others right now. And to me, in terms of consistency, you cannot get much better than that with 7 years on the bounce. And there's every chance it'll be exactly the same next year when, I mean, there's so many people you can talk about that bring that team together, but, you know, led by Toto Wolff, etc. You can't really do much better than that, in my opinion.
And Formula One in recent, sort of in the last couple of decades, has seen these periods of domination by one team, which is a shame because you like to see as many people fighting for race victories and for the title as possible. And that's why I think back to the 2010 season when Red Bull won their first title with Vettel. But actually going into the last two races, 5 drivers from 3 different teams could still have won that title. That's when F1's it is most exciting. But yeah, what Mercedes have done since the rule change came in and the turbo hybrid engines came in 2014 is incredible. And the fact is they're always one step ahead of everyone else. As soon as Red Bull, as soon as Ferrari seem to have caught them up, they produce something else and they go that bit further ahead. It's a remarkable. And this season wasn't incident free. Think back to Monza and Lewis Hamilton's penalty for taking a pit stop when the pit lane was closed. And then you think about what happened to poor George Russell at the Bahrain or the Sakhir Grand Prix when he had a victory stolen because of a mix-up at the pit stops and then a puncture as well. So it's not been plain sailing this season, but it's incredible the relentlessness of that team. And then to hear them turn around and say, you know, or Mercedes could be pulling out Formula One in a couple of years, or Toto Wolff could be leaving, or Lewis Hamilton could be leaving, is to think like, no, surely not, because it's just remarkable what they continue to achieve. And yes, people can say it's boring, and it is sometimes a little bit boring when it's just Mercedes dominating, but you cannot take away from the fact that what they've done is unheard of in a lot of sports. Whenever you get the same team winning the title 7 years in a row.
Yeah. I don't know why you can criticize excellence in my book. If if it's boring, shouldn't the onus be on other teams to step up, sort of thing? It's kind of how I see it.
And the racing this season, I think 2020 has been one of the best years for Formula One. And some of the races have been exceptional. I mean, we've had some big crashes, which everyone likes to see. Fortunately, you know, there were no serious injuries, although Romain Grosjean was
came close.
Like, and the restart at Tuscany as well, that could have been so much worse. But the actual racing has been really good. And to see a couple of surprise winners in Perez and Gasly this year, you have Verstappen win a couple of races. Yes, Mercedes still ended up dominating, but it was a good year for Formula One. And teams, you know, it looked like Red Bull are catching them up, Mercedes. Will that be the case at the start of next season? Probably not. Mercedes will probably take in a step ahead again. But if you've got a team that are dominating, but the racing is still good and enjoyable to watch, and you do get the odd surprise winner, you can't complain that much.
Nah, definitely. Agreed. Our winner. Joint winner. We agree on everything.
No, we don't.
No, we don't. But on this one, we do. Can we go for it?
I'll let you say it.
Okay. It's the England women's rugby team, who have disrupted 2020, obviously. But their Six Nations performance, ridiculous. Ridiculously incredible, again. Played five, won five, 219.4, 20 against. That's a big differential. And I know you touched on the France game before when you're talking about the best moments. And as is always said, if you can pull yourself when you're not quite at the top of your game to somehow winning, that is one hell of a mark of a great team. And it essentially shows just what a machine that group of players have become. And we're going to talk about her again a little bit later on, but if you've got Emily Scarrett and co on top form, that is one hell of a force when you're an opposition player to be dealing with. And 2020 as well, the second year that they've won the Grand Slam. So again, if we're going back to the consistency argument, to be doing it over that time frame, definitely something to shout about. And they don't look like they're going to be stopping anytime soon anyway.
A lot of people have said, oh, England needs to play tougher opposition. And that's very difficult at the moment because, I mean, France are third or fourth in the world. So that's tough. And they proved that in the Six Nations game. It was, 19-13, I think, to England. That was a proper scrap. And in that second game in the autumn, that was a really, really good close game. New Zealand, obviously, is currently ranked second in the world now because England have gone back to number one for, I think, the second time in their history. Canada as well are a good team. People are saying England needs to pit themselves against those sorts of teams, but you can only beat what you play against. And the fact is that England steamrolled their way past Scotland, Ireland, Wales and Italy in the Six Nations. I don't think they lost it. They didn't lose a game in 2020, did they? They've scored however many tries. And what I think is so strong about this team at the moment is the strength in depth. If you lose a couple of players, you've still got the backups waiting in reserve who could quite easily make the first 15. So if you look at the wings, where you think, oh, Jess Breach is injured, like, what are England going to do? Well, actually, no, you've got Ellie Kildon, you've got Kelly Smith, you've got whoever, Lydia Thompson, you know, where's she at the moment? She's not been able to play because other players are ahead of her, and yet she's a World Cup winner. It's ridiculous. And they've had some players come back from the Sevens programme, which had folded at the time, such as Alex Matthews. She's come back and fitted into the England team. You've got Meg Jones as well, who's in and around. So the move to professionalise the women's team finally on a full-time basis is really, really starting to pay off now. And England are number one ranked in the world. They're imperious. So yeah, they've got the World Cup. I just hope they haven't peaked too soon, because they've got the World Cup coming up, which is still due to take place next summer. And they've got Australia and France in their groups. That's not that's a tough group to have. What you don't want is for them to be performing at their absolute best now, and then by the time they get to that World Cup, they've peaked and they've started coming down. Obviously, Katie Daly-McLean deciding to retire now is quite a big shock. I don't know how many of us outside of sort of that inner circle that saw that coming, but
she said it was a clear decision, didn't she?
She retires, but then that just means Emily Scarrett's going to be starting at 10, or Zoe Harrison moves to 10 and Scarrett's at 12, and then you've got other players who can come in and fill those positions. Like, the scrap for scrum half at the moment is ridiculous. You've got Mo Hunt, you've got Leanne Riley, you've got Claudia McDonald. Each of those could quite easily be in your first 15, and yet potentially one of them might not go to the World Cup. It's ridiculous. So what they've achieved this year is amazing, and I just hope next year that they can win that World Cup and stay ranked number one in the world.
Definitely. Good place to be. So, next category, after this quick break, is the big one, Athlete of the Year. So then, Athlete of the Year, the most prestigious award that this podcast can probably hand out to any one individual. We take it very, very seriously. We have our contenders, but this time, unlike the last category, we do not agree on who is placed where. We've got some similar names, but our placings are quite different. Shall I kick off with Emily Scarrett, who is my first nominee? And again, echoing on a lot of the stuff that we said before, she is a large part of the reason why the England rugby team are where they are now. She was the reigning World Player of the Year up until about 2 weeks ago when the new awards got dished out. But still, that's something to be very proud of throughout most of 2020. And she ultimately helped England in that Six Nations Grand Slam win, and was named Player of the Tournament in that campaign. She also became England's highest point scorer in history during the Six Nations as well. And if you think of everything that she does and continues to do for her country, she's still got some years left ahead of her as well. She's, 30 now? And she's already a legend of the England rugby game, and there's plenty more to come from her. And as I'll probably argue about again later on, I don't know why she didn't get more recognition at Sports Personality of the Year, because I would have had her shortlisted. But she wasn't.
The thing is, Emily Scarrett is one of those players that could quite easily be shortlisted every year. Because, like you said about Marcus Rashford, I don't think I've ever seen her have a bad game. Okay, there may be one or two games where her kickings might not be as good as perhaps she'd like it to be. But then that doesn't matter when you're setting up however many tries and dominating the middle of the park. She's just... consistency is a massive thing in sport, and she's one of the most consistent performers out there. She's just unbelievable. And I remember when she was part of the England Sevens team, and they were ambition. Sometimes if the elite athlete gym was busy, they'd come and use the plebs gym for their workout. And I remember being next to her on the bike, on the Watt bike. Oh God. I was looking at her screen, and the figure she was pulling off were insane, and yet she barely looked like she was sweating. She's just such a remarkable athlete.
If you ever want to see the difference between pro athlete and the rest of us, go to the plebs gym
at Bisham Abbey, and then get one of the rowers or one of the rugby sevens players, and get us doing the same thing on the Watt bike, and you'll see the difference. But consistency is massive, as I said, in sport, and someone who I think is slightly wavered in his consistency over the years, is come back this year and had one of the most remarkable summers ever, and that's Stuart Broad. I mean, people were writing off at the start of the summer. You didn't get picked for the first test. Woods and Archer and Anderson got picked, and everyone was saying, oh, that's it. That's over. It's over for Stuart Broad. And he wrote in the Daily Mail earlier this month that actually he was questioning, you know, is it over for me? Am I no longer England's first choice? The second test came about, and a couple of injuries to Wood and Anderson and Archer breaking the biosecure bubble code meant that Broad was back in, and wow, what a performance. I mean, he... Across, I think, five tests he played in the summer, he took 29 wickets, an average of 13.41 runs per wicket, which is remarkable figures. They're unheard of a lot of his, for so many wickets in cricket. He also took his 500th test wicket as well, becoming one of a very, very select few of seamers to ever do that. The thing was, he proved all the doubters wrong. He didn't come out in the media and start sort of slating anyone, saying, oh, I deserve to be in this team. Like, he sort of kept himself to himself. And he's been in and out of the team a little bit over the last couple of years. You think back to the tour of Sri Lanka in 2018, and he didn't play every game there. Last summer in the Ashes, he was England's talisman because Anderson was unfit, although Archer was more of the wicket taker. Broad had a very good summer, but yeah, people have been questioning his place in the team. He didn't play all the tests in South Africa. So to come back and produce a summer like that was incredible, and proved that, yes, he's 34, but he's still got a lot of cricket left in him. And yeah, that's the way to silence the doubters, is to do it on the pitch. And he did that, and then some.
Yeah, he mentioned that at Spotty as well, didn't he? Just how sort of the determination to prove that he wasn't done, really sort of ignited a fire in the belly. And definitely has helped him regain his first place status. So, and he was rightfully recognised, I think, by being on the shortlist for what he's managed to do this year. My second nominee might be mentioned again later on by someone else, but Lewis Hamilton, again, what a year for him again, as he tied level with Michael Schumacher's record of 7 drivers' titles. There's that word again, consistency. It is incredible what he manages to pull off year after year. And I remember Michael Schumacher racing, and I'm pretty sure around the time that, like, no one really had any inkling that someone was going to go and match that this quickly, relatively speaking, in terms of when Schumacher was last in a championship-winning car. But everything... every chance, really, that Hamilton will go on to surpass that, considering what he's got left in the tank, car pun right there. And yeah, he has shown himself again to be one of this country's best performing consistent athletes of all time. And he's from Hertfordshire, so there's a Hearts Live reference for you right there. I've actually got a report on that one. But also, this kind of links in with my Marcus Rashford stuff as well. He's also not been silent this year in terms of his campaigning and wanting to push for change, and particularly a lot of the stuff around when the Black Lives Matter movement was happening and his calls for or a protest for anti-racism and trying to promote diversity and equal opportunity and all that sort of stuff around the same time. But again, as I mentioned with Marcus Rashford, to still be competing at that elite level so consistently while having all this other stuff going on at the same time, it just boggles the mind. I don't know how people have the brain capacity to do that, considering, I mean, we're both knackered when we've had a day at work. Yeah, they go and do all this extracurricular stuff, which feels fair to, you know, class it as that, but, you know, it's all these bits and bobs they've got on the side that they're so passionate about in the same way. I just don't know how they have the same energy to keep doing that on both, on all quarters, really. And to top it all off, of course, he did win Sports Personality of the Year, and I voted for him, so I know what I'm talking about.
More on Lewis Hamilton later. I don't want to say my piece too soon. I think I've gone slightly rogue with this selection, but she deserves a mention.
You had to go rogue at some point. It's expected of you.
I mean, probably Shona McCallum's first goal for GB is quite rogue as well in the context, but... for me, I love my cricket, so it is another cricketer. But what this person has done have it and they've only just turned 21 is exceptional. So for me, my second nominee for Athlete of the Year is Sophie Eccleston. And I don't know if there is a spinner in world cricket, men's or women's, who is just as consistent as she is at the moment. She just, if she bowls a bad, she bowls like one bad ball a game. Like that's her accuracy, her line and length, her control, the pressure she puts on is remarkable. And that was proven at the T20 World Cup earlier this year. So she took 8 wickets in 4 games of an average of 6.12 runs per wicket, which again is nuts. But what really, the figure that really stands out is her economy rates. It's the number of runs a bowler concedes in an over. And in a women's 2020 game, if you're conceding less than 7 runs an over, you've done pretty well. And you look at the top wicket takers in that tournament, they all average around sort of 5.9 to 6.5 runs per over conceded. Sophie Eccleston's economy rate in that tournament was 3.23 runs per over. That's the sort of economy rate you expect in a test match where you've got 5 days to bat, not 20 overs. The pressure she puts on the batters, she doesn't, like I said, she barely bowls a bad ball. She just doesn't give them anything to work with. And for a 21-year-old to show that level of consistency and that maturity in terms of her performances is amazing. And then I think she was the fourth highest wicket taker in the tournament, but she only played 4 games. And then it came to the home 2020s that the England women played the summer, and she dominated that as well. I think she took wickets in every game. She barely conceded any runs. She made the opposition batters look really, really poor at times. She's got 56 wickets in just 39 T20 matches. She's now the number one ranked 2020 bowler in the world in the women's game. And she's 21. She could be around for another 20 years if she wants it to be. It's just incredible. And that's incredible for England women that they've managed to find a talent like that as well.
Well argued. Not my winner, though. So I'm going to read out some achievements about my winner. So, FA Cup winner 2020, Champions League winner 2020, Division 1 Feminine winner 2020, Coupe de France Feminine winner 2020, BBC Women's Footballer of the Year winner 2020, FIFA the Best Women's Player of the Year winner 2020. And to my mind, you cannot have a better 2020 than that when you've won pretty much every team and every individual honour you are eligible for. And if you haven't guessed it yet, it's Lucy Bronze, who is now back at Manchester City, of course. But what a year. Can you really say any more than what she's actually achieved? She's gone over to France with Lyon, won pretty much everything there is to win. And every time you see her on a pitch, she is just such a standout player. She has been for obviously such a long time for the England team, and when you watch her at club level as well. But it's just her, again, here we go, talking about consistency again. Her consistency on it every time she plays. And to get the recognition as well as a defender, because personally speaking, I think it's a lot harder for defenders to get that level of recognition in terms of the best world awards. I think a lot of the time it favours sort of strikers and midfielders, if you like. So that again just shows what she brings to the game, both defensively but also offensively when she's bombing forward from right back. Yes, Manchester City may be fourth right now. They had a relatively slow start to the WSL season. But as I mentioned at the start, they did win the FA Cup, technically last year's FA Cup. But hey, scheduling doesn't mean anything anymore. And even though they are fourth, they are still one of the 4 teams battling out for that WSL title as well. So they will undoubtedly still be up there come the season's end as well. And it's not often we get to say in this country that we have the best footballer in the world. She was a man. People be all over it, just saying. So yeah, I, again, it's like, salute what she's managed to do in her career. She is next level in terms of performance. One hell of an achievement to do what she'd done. And again, it's another one where I sort of am baffled at why she and Emily Scarrett were not on the Spotty shortlist, considering what they've done this year. As I said to you at the start, before we began recording, I would have booted Ronnie O'Sullivan and Tyson Fury. Sorry, Ronnie and Tyson, in favour of those two.
Not sorry, it's Tyson.
I know we have our predetermined opinions on that, which we've mentioned before. But yeah, I would have booted those two in favour of having them both on the shortlist. But yeah, Lucy Bronze is my athlete of 2020.
I mean, it's difficult to argue with that, but I've gone for Lewis Hamilton because as a massive Formula One fan, I never thought that Michael Schumacher's record of race wins or championships would be equaled or beaten. So to have seen Lewis Hamilton do what he's done in the last few years is incredible. And yes, he's had the best car, but we mentioned it again, consistency. He's taken part in 14 Grand Prix seasons now. He's won at least one race in every single season. That's never been done before. That's incredible. And in a couple of those years, he had a really uncompetitive car as well. So to have achieved that, to have done that, to have won in every single season he's been in, to have consistently been at the front of the field, to have taken 98 pole positions now, where he broke the record 2-3 years ago, previously held by Ayrton Senna, 95 Grand Prix victories now. It's obscene. He doesn't really make a mistake. And I think back to maybe Brazil last year when he knocked Alex Albon out of the race. That was a mistake, and he owned up to it and said, yeah, I made a mistake. But they're very, very few and far between. And he hadn't missed the race since his debut in 2007 until he missed the penultimate race of the season with coronavirus, which is 265 race starts. I'm just on Wikipedia, and he's got more than 40 world records to his name at the moment. No one has ever finished on the podium more than him. No one's ever won more races than him. Only one other person has matched him in terms of title victories. He was, at the time, the youngest driver to lead the world championship. He's done this, he's done that. He's just... I mean, people have differences of opinion of him in terms of personality. I was one where everybody loved him at the start of his career, then thought he became a bit of a dick. Now I think he's brilliant again. What he does on and off the track is amazing. And like you said, to have anyone who's the best in the world that's British is quite weird. We're not very good at sort of recognising how good we can be at stuff, but to have arguably the greatest Formula One driver of all time, and to say he's British and he's from Hertfordshire is amazing. But yeah. Question was asked that, was he named amongst Hertfordshire's sexiest inhabitants?
Thank you for pointing that one out. He was actually. He didn't take top spot though, in terms of the men's list. And he lost out to Bradley Walsh in terms of the men's.
All right, he probably should have won that one.
I'd like to say on record that I had no input in the list, just saying. But it was done on an exclusive scientific basis.
Of course.
But going on for the Lewis Hamilton point that you raised, and I suppose this is something I've particularly working in Hertfordshire News, as I do, does the predetermined opinions about his personality does that mean we don't appreciate him the way we should? Because I think it does, based on previous comments that he's made. As when we posted, when he equaled Michael Schumacher's record of drivers' championships and posted it on our Facebook page, and the comments were not complimentary, basically referring us to a time where he slagged off Stevenage, where he's from, and people didn't seem to have forgiven him for that.
He did have that phase where he was quite difficult in the media, and he did like to throw a few accusations around and stuff. It probably has stuck with him, but I think more in recent years, people have started to let it slide. Maybe not the people of Stevenage, but people have started to let it slide a bit more because they see now what he's doing for the sport and what he's doing for society outside of it as well. I think they still stick around, but I definitely don't. I think given the fact he's won, how many times has he been nominated or won Spotty now? Quite a few.
He's won it twice now, hasn't he?
I think people are recognising just what a mercurial talent he is and have maybe forgiven him slightly for his previous indiscretions in interviews and what have you.
Except the people of Stevenage.
Always wants to bear a grudge.
Exactly. But hey, he can clear a place on his mantelpiece as well. I'm sure it's quite a long one for the joint Sports Bill Athlete of the Year award. I'm sure he'll appreciate no end. So, that is it for the review of 2020. And we hardly mentioned that virus at all during that. So that's a bit of an achievement, I think. Some final messages before we pop off for 2020 and reappear in 2021. The Bear. People haven't heard us going on about that enough. We are now a member of The Bear Radio. So if you have nothing to do on a Monday night at 10 o'clock, why not flick on the radio and listen to us instead? The positive being, you'll either hear some really engaging chat that you'll love, or we'll be so dull you'll just go to sleep when you're supposed to go to sleep. So you've got the best of both worlds, really.
Or we're so our voices are so relaxing, people will go to sleep.
Yeah, let's go with that. And then I think we've got to finish off with some thank yous this year at the same time. First one, obviously, to the Mintage Foundation and everything they continue to do, both with their programs and their overall work. And it is, we've said this enough times, but it's worth repeating. We really, really love being a part of that family. We were on their Christmas call, what was it, last week, playing some mad games and doing the Mastermind final as well. And yeah, it's a relationship we continue to value so much. And again, showing the best in people, what that group of athletes and individuals, they care so passionately about the work they do. And yeah, it's great to be a part of. And I suppose our final thank you should be to you, the people, the listeners, and everyone who has helped with this podcast, whether it's spreading the world, just enjoying what we do, listening in to our interviews, and it's essentially why we keep doing it. And while this year has certainly been a lot harder than all the others we've been doing this show in terms of getting episodes out there and trying to organise our lives when usually we'd be able to meet up and all that sort of stuff. From personal experience, it's been the toughest year we've been doing this show, but still, nonetheless, when we do get those episodes out there, it does feel like a little win every time we do it. So for anyone who's enjoyed that at some point this year, we thank you for tuning in, basically. Anything else you want to add on to that?
Well, I mean, thank you to the guests as well. We've had some amazing guests this year and some high profile guests, and always a pleasure to chat to them about anything. And we've covered quite a lot of topics this year as well. It's not been easy, both in terms of logistics and also just motivation. It's when you're stuck in the same place every day, finding motivation to do stuff can be quite difficult, but it's always enjoyable. And yeah, hopefully next year we'll be able to bring you even bigger and better interviews, more high profile names, hopefully predict a few Olympic gold medals along the way.
Yeah, maybe this time it'll actually happen.
Well, if not this year, then it won't ever happen. So
yeah,
next year even.
Really hope that doesn't come to pass. And I suppose going on with that, thank you to all the communications individuals, the PRs, who have essentially helped us and been willing to work with us, because we know it's not always hands down yes every time we come along and be like, can we chat to your athlete? But there are a lot of people out there who do give you the time and do give you the access, and that is always massively appreciated for people like us when all we're doing is trying to bring a little bit of entertainment and a bit of fun to people's days. So that does not go unrecognised on our part. That's it. 2020 is done. Nearly done.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are out. I mean, we're recording this on Christmas Eve. This goes out after Christmas, but nonetheless, we do wish everyone a Merry Christmas slash period after Christmas, and also a Happy New Year as well. And I don't think that phrase has ever been more heartfelt and meaningful as it is this year.
A happy and better new year.
Yeah, we really do wish that 2021 brings us all a little bit more happiness and joy and a bit more freedom than we've had throughout 2020. I know there's going to be a lot of challenges still to come for a lot of people, but I suppose from our experience, every day at a time, every hour at a time, just keep going on and we'll feel the better for it by the time the year is out. So that is it from myself, that's it from Will, and we look forward to seeing you all, speaking to you all again in 2021.